Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
All right, we talk about this guy all the time and his interesting in-depth articles on ESPN.com. Senior NFL writer for ESPN.com, host of the Bill Barnwell Show, available wherever you get your podcast. That would be Bill Barnwell joins us here on 98.7. Bill, we appreciate a couple minutes. Hope you and the family and everyone is well during this difficult time.
Yeah, likewise, guys. Hope you're doing okay.
All right, so let's get to it. Your most recent article on ESPN.com about 2020 NFL draft surprises. Why do the Packers and Eagles draft quarterbacks Jordan Love and Jalen Hurts? So give us kind of your overview, because we've had a lot of debate on this show. Do you like what the Packers slash Eagles did with the backup quarterback for the foreseeable future is concerned?
Yeah, in different ways, though. With the Packers, I do think if you have a guy you love in Jordan Love, I think it's a reasonable risk to take him at the end of the first round. I think this Packers team, honestly, a little overrated. You look at the numbers for them. I know 13-3. I know NFC Championship game. They got blown out twice, actually, by the Niners. They were actually not that close to making it to the Super Bowl. And a team that, the Vegas over-under came out for them, and there was 8.5, I think. I mean, it is a team that I think everyone kind of expects to take a step backwards. So I don't know if they were one receiver away. I think their defense was worse than the offense. I think they could have added maybe a linebacker instead of adding a receiver. Now, granted, second round, taking A.J. Dillon, the running back out of B.C., don't see the logic in that. I do think you go and add a wide receiver at that point. Maybe they trade for someone like a Kenny Stills at this point or a Dante Pettis. I think adding a veteran might make sense, but I think Jordan Love is fine. I think the other moves, not adding a wide receiver elsewhere, doesn't make sense for the Packers. For the Eagles, I mean, you have to be realistic, right? Carson Wentz has played 4 years. He has lasted to the end of the season once in those 4 years. They made it to the playoffs 3 times. He's played a total of 1/4 in those 3 playoff games. So you have to be realistic about your options. You can't expect Carson Wentz to play 16 games and play into the postseason. If you get it, it's a bonus, but you can't rely upon it. And this is a team that does have cap issues. They are really kind of stretched financially when it comes to their cap. So you have to draft a running. You have to draft a quarterback. You can't really go out for a Marcus Mariota and pay him $7, $8 million a year. So drafting Jalen Hurts as a backup, as a guy who could take some of those snaps in short yardage, I'd love to sneak Carson Wentz. Sneaking Hurts, I think, instead would be a similarly effective option. So I see the logic in both. You know, I think obviously there are some fans who are going to be frustrated. But at the end of the day, you know, I mean, Packers fans didn't want the Packers to draft Aaron Rodgers all those years ago. They wanted Brett Favre to get a defensive player for a team that had been 10-6 and been a playoff team the year before. And I think it worked out okay in the long run.
Yeah, it still doesn't make any sense to me, Bill, to be completely honest. I mean, you gave up assets. No, but you know what bothered me about it, and I'm not even a Packers fan, is, I mean, you gave up a 4th-round pick to go up and select the quarterback, and this wasn't a quarterback, and I mean, Aaron Rodgers was going to be or could have been the number one pick in that draft, and he just so happened to fall to the Packers. So, I mean, I can understand that more. What actually aggravated me in reading some of the quotes coming out of Green Bay was, you know, we like the top 12 wide receivers, and, you know, when Justin Jefferson was gone, then we realized, well, if you love Justin Jefferson, why wouldn't you trade up to get Justin Jefferson? As opposed to you traded up to get a quarterback that's not even going to help your team for the next 2 years. That didn't make sense to me.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I see your point. But what I would say is, you know, are we that confident about Justin Jefferson that having a trade-up makes sense? Maybe they are. Maybe they think he's going to be a superstar. Maybe he'll be great. But, you know, I think in reality, you look at history, you look at the wide receivers in that range, there are some really talented players. DJ Moore comes to mind as a guy who was drafted in that range. But we've seen guys like Laquon Treadwell taken by the same Vikings who took Justin Jefferson. And you know, you've seen a mix of guys who, aren't necessarily that effective in that range, in that 10-pick range over the last decade. Those guys have averaged about 500 yards a year, which is, you know, it's something. It helps, but it's not as if you can get a guaranteed game changer. If it was the idea of a guaranteed, you know, number two starting wide receiver who's going to be effective, going to get 800 yards a year versus Jordan Love, I would say, yeah, take the wide receiver. But we don't know if the wide receiver is going to even be that effective. So I would almost rather say, hey, draft Jordan Love, trade a 4th-round pick, which is, you know, it's something, but it's not that much in the long run. And then if you can trade a 6th-round pick to the Texans for Kenny Stills, who's making $8 million, who's their 4th wide receiver, I kind of prefer that option to drafting a guy in the first round. Especially if you're thinking you want to optimize these last 2 years for Aaron Rodgers, I think getting a veteran is probably going to help you more than getting a rookie.
And Bill, you kind of led me into the question that I wanted to ask. Anytime a team uses a first round pick on a position, it usually spells trouble for the incumbent vet. The clock is ticking. You think it'll be 2 years and then the Packers will turn it over to Jordan Love?
I think that makes the most sense. It could be 1 year, theoretically. You know, if they want to eat, I think it's about $36 million in dead cap, which is totally unprecedented. But not impossible, I guess, if you really want to get rid of Aaron Rodgers. Here's what I would say, though, and I don't know what you guys think about this. I think it's 2 years. I think Aaron Rodgers is probably not the most happy person on the planet when it comes to this move. But here's what I would say. Aaron Rodgers is someone who is motivated by skepticism. He's someone who's motivated by doubters, which is true of a lot of people. But Aaron Rodgers, when he got drafted in 2005, and he did fall to, I think, 24, he was motivated by that, as you might expect for a guy who could have been the first overall pick and had not only, you know, the Niners pass on him, but also a bunch of teams down the line pass on him before they got to 24. So if you're Aaron Rodgers and the Packers are saying, hey, we think we can move on from you, we think we have this guy, this quarterback of the future, are you going to be upset and kind of curl into a ball and not want to play? Or are you going to be motivated to play the best football of your career to prove to the Packers that, hey, I'm not going anywhere. This is my team. This is my offense. And I'm going to lead this team to the Super Bowl no matter what you do. I could see this being a positive thing for Aaron Rodgers in some strange way.
Bill Barnwell joining us here, senior NFL writer for ESPN.com. You know, a lot of people question what the Giants have done over the last couple of years. Do you finally, Bill, think that this team is heading in the right direction, or do you still scratch your head about where the Giants are right now?
You know, I think they're sort of in between. You know, you see the logic sort of behind some of the moves they've made and some of the moves also that make much sense. Leonard Williams trade, you know, I'm waiting. I'm waiting to hear an argument that justifies it or explains it to
me. It's terrible. It doesn't exist, Bill. It does not exist. Right. It's a ridiculous trade. You could have signed him without trading a third and a fifth this offseason.
Right. But Daniel Jones, I mean, hey, I was pretty skeptical of Daniel Jones. That was inconsistent, I think it's fair to say, but it's definitely some promise in his rookie year. And now you see adding pieces around him. You know, the weapons are pretty good. Now you draft Andrew Thomas with the fourth overall pick. You take Matt Pert in the third round. They have Will Hernandez. They drafted that first year when Gettleman was there. You know, there is an infrastructure surrounding around Daniel Jones. So now, whether Daniel Jones is going to be good or not, in a vacuum, we don't know. But he has, you know, pretty much one of the better cores around him when it comes to young talent in football, even without Odell Beckham. So, you know, in the long run, do I agree with every move Dave Gettleman made? No, absolutely not. Is there still problems on the defense? Yeah, there's major problems on that defense. But in terms of evaluating your young quarterback, which is the most important thing you have to do in the NFL, is draft a young quarterback and then develop him into a viable starter, I think the Giants are doing pretty well, all things considered. So a mix, up and down.
Bill Barnwell joins us here on the show. Bill, I'm a huge Jets fan. Just give me overall, you know, how you feel the Jets and Joe Douglas in his first draft did.
I think pretty good. Overall, I think you have the same thing, right? Where you want to evaluate Sam Darnold, you drafted a bunch of offensive linemen this offseason, you had Rashad Perryman, and then hey, first pick Mekhi Becton, second pick Denzel Mims. So you had, you know, a guy who can be a viable number one wideout, number two wideout, and then a franchise left tackle if everything pans out. They still have to develop those guys, just the Giants have to develop their guys, but you see the logic, you see a plan forming around Sam Darnold, and this is the make or break year, right? You know, if Sam Darnold struggles this year, you have to consider moving on. You can't wait any longer. But if he shows promise, then hey, he's going to be your guy of the future. So I think it's an enormous year for him, and I think a logical plan from the Jets this offseason to kind of see what they have with Sam Darnold.
Bill, the Bengals released Andy Dalton yesterday. Everybody's throwing him on the short list with Cam Newton as quarterbacks that the New England Patriots should be interested in. So I guess I got a two-part question. First of which, when do you think we'll see Andy Dalton and Cam Newton signed? And then secondly, are the Patriots content with going into the season with Jarrett Stidham as QB1?
Every week I sit here to myself and I say, they can't be, right? You know, they have to be doing something. There has to be some plan from Bill Belichick to not have Jarrett Stidham starting week one. But I think they are actually comfortable with it. I think they are willing to consider that as an option. I think they're willing to have a competition and willing to think Jarrett Stidham might win that competition. I think they do have faith in Jarrett Stidham, but I think Andy Dalton makes too much sense for the Patriots as a team that wants to minimize turnovers, a guy that wants to, you know, they want to play it safe. They want to win games with their defense. They want to win games probably running the football this year. I think adding Andy Dalton to that roster makes sense. I think Cam Newton is a better quarterback. I think he has much more upside, but the injuries are a concern, which is why, to get to the first point of your question, I think Andy Dalton's going to sign before Cam Newton because I think people are a lot more comfortable with Andy Dalton's physical health right now than they are with Cam Newton's health. And I think, you know, Cam, in a typical offseason, he would have been able to work out. He would have been able to, you know, give full medicals to teams. That's just not an option right now. We're seeing it with guys like Jadeveon Clowney as well, where, you know, if you were able to give a full medical workup for these guys, you might feel more comfortable giving them a bigger deal than what they might be getting from teams now. So I think with Cam, you know, I think it might take until the summer before he's really able to work out, show teams what he can do, and then sign a contract. So Andy Dalton, you know, I think the Patriots and the Jaguars come to mind as the two teams, and that could happen in the next week or two.
Bill Barnwell joining us here, 98.7 ESPN. Let's run through the teams that we kind of love where they're at. And for me, that starts with what they did last year, this offseason so far, the trade, the draft, and that is the San Francisco 49ers. It feels like they are one of, if not the class of the NFC right now.
Yeah, absolutely. They were a team that, you know, I was predicting to make the playoffs this time last year, which was a pretty small bandwagon at that point. I didn't think they'd make it to the Super Bowl, but, you know, this is a team that I think has a coherent plan, right? Like, you always want to see a team that has logic and decision behind what they're doing. And so with the Niners, I mean, you're trading Forrest Buckner, which is, you know, a big trade for a guy who was a superstar defensive lineman, but Anjon Kinlaw doesn't necessarily replace DeForest Buckner, but it gives you another option in that defensive line. So you kind of stick with that deep defensive line core. And then they're the first round pick. You had Brandon Ayuk, a guy who I think, you know, in the wrong scheme with the wrong coordinator would really struggle. With the right coordinator in the right scheme could be a really impactful player. And I think that obviously Kyle Shanahan can be that guy for him. And you're adding another weapon for Jimmy Garoppolo. Every year they draft a wide receiver. They add a running back. They add weapons for Jimmy Garoppolo and for Kyle Shanahan to work with. And those guys, you know, they're not going to be the, you know, Julio Jones 1,500-yard guy, but they're going to be guys who, you know, can play 60, 70% of the snaps in the game and have an impact and scare defenses every time they're on the football field. So I love that they're sticking to their plan. I think they are, you know, again, if they're not the best team in the NFC, I mean, the Saints are up there, but I think they're awful close.
Yeah, Bill, after going through the, you know, the offseason and then, and we'll still have the second wave of free agency or whatever it ends up being, but the offseason in the draft, are we still looking at, you know, a similar situation to what we saw last year? Again, this is all on paper, but, you know, having the Ravens and the Kansas City Chiefs as the class of the AFC, and then, like you just mentioned, the Saints and the San Francisco 49ers is kind of that class of the NFC?
Yeah, I would figure. But, you know, I mean, think about it, you know, this time last year, looking at the Rams, thinking, hey, the Rams are bringing back all of their stars. They're, you know, have an incredibly young, talented team. The Rams kind of fell apart. You know, I think with the Ravens, they're a team that come to mind for me is, hey, you know, if Lamar Jackson gets hurt or if, you know, teams do find a way to slow down that rushing offense, which I don't think they'll be able to stop it altogether, but maybe slow it down. Maybe we'll see the Ravens struggle. Maybe we'll see them take a step backwards. That's hardly out of the question. But I think, you know, unless that happens, until that happens, I do think we're going to see kind of the same teams in the mix there. You can see like the Cowboys maybe taking a leap forward or a team like the Packers taking a step backwards. But, yeah, I just think the Saints are so deep. They're so talented. They have so many options at every position. The Niners, again, kind of in the same vein. And then, yeah, I think the Ravens are in great shape. I think the Chiefs are, you know, the class of the conference for me because the Patriots are taking a step backwards. Maybe we'll see the Bills or the Steelers kind of take a leap forward if they get better quarterback play in 2020. But I do think we're going to kind of see the same, you know, three or four teams kind of be in the running by the time we get to December.
Bill, I want to ask you about three young star quarterbacks. The Chiefs and the Texans exercised the fifth-year options on Pat Mahomes and Deshaun Watson. And, of course, Dak Prescott got the exclusive franchise tag from the Dallas Cowboys at $31 million for the upcoming season. When do you think the timeline is for those extensions to actually get done? Because I don't think that anybody expects for those guys to ultimately play long-term on their current deals.
Yeah, I think it depends on how comfortable each guy is with making a deal. I start with Deshaun Watson. I think he's the first, you know, and obviously a superstar player negotiating with a guy in Bill O'Brien, who I think, you know, we all think maybe is not the toughest person to negotiate a contract with. So I think Deshaun Watson should get a very impressive deal and deserves one. He's a fantastic football player and going to be the core of that team for years to come. With Pat Mahomes, it's tough because I think Pat Mahomes could ask for the moon. He could ask for a, you know, a Mike Trout level deal in terms of what he's proven over his first 3 years. And for the Chiefs, they still have him for 2 years on relatively cheap deals, and then a franchise tag, you know, would be even cheaper than signing him for 3 years probably. So, you know, Pat Mahomes wants to be the first $40 million a year quarterback and deserves it. Well, do you sign now when you don't really have that leverage? Do you wait a year and then you can realistically ask for whatever you want because you're 1 year closer to free agency? So I think that could be a very tough one to do. It might actually take until next offseason to get that done. And then Dak Prescott, I mean, you know, if it was going to happen, if it was going to be that easy, why hasn't it happened yet? You know, what are the Cowboys waiting for? If they think Dak Prescott's price tag is too high, I have some bad news. It's only going up. It's not going to get any cheaper in the years to come as other quarterbacks sign, mm-hmm. as the cap goes up, possibly dramatically. I mean, the example I think of here, and it's scary for Cowboys fans, is Kirk Cousins, a guy who, you know, wanted a multi-year deal. Washington did not want to do it. His price tag stayed the same, went up a little bit. He kept playing well, you know, and the Washington didn't want to do it, so they ended up losing him for a third-round pick in free agency. They used a second-round pick to trade for Alex Smith. That ended up being a disaster. They used a first-round pick on Dwayne Haskins, and obviously the jury's still out on him, but they still haven't solved their quarterback situation. And for the Cowboys, I mean, if you're not willing to sign Dak Prescott now, I don't know what you're waiting for, because it's only going to go up, and your quarterback situation is only going to get messier. So there's a chance that they lose him in 2 years unless they sign a contract with him probably this offseason. So I can't believe it hasn't happened yet, and I'm fascinated to see where it goes. But if I'm a Cowboys fan, I have to be worried about losing Dak Prescott for basically nothing.
This is the best news we've heard all day. Bill, the fact that you can bring this news to our attention here in New York Sports Talk Radio is just, it's so refreshing and really uplifting. Just wonderful. Thank
you.
Listen, Bill, we know you got to run, so we'd love to keep you on forever, but we know you got to run. Join us again really soon, and we'll chop it up about the NFL. Great stuff.
Yeah, we'd love to. Anytime.
All right, great. That's Bill Barnwell joining us here, 98.7 ESPN. Very good. Very informative. He's smarter than most people, I think.
Yeah, he's taking deep dives, man.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not scratching the surface. He goes deep. I mean, the article he wrote about the Green Bay decision with Love and then the Eagles decision with Jalen Hurts. I mean, some of the numbers and everything else, one score games. I kind of understand why the Eagles did it. And if I was the Eagles, I mean, especially that concussion that, I mean, it was a dirty hit, but still, I mean, the concussion that ended Wentz's season, that would have scared the hell out of me. Cause he hasn't been healthy, period. But I mean, the fact is, I mean, to see Andrew Luck walk away, Carson Wentz has made a lot of money. You start talking concussions like that, man, that scares the hell out of me if I'm the Eagles.
Well, it should.
But as far as Green Bay's concerned, man, I mean, what has Matt LaFleur done that you're going to go all in with Matt LaFleur being able to develop Jordan Love? He hasn't done anything. Nothing. It wasn't like the Green Bay offense was, you know, one of the best in the NFL last year. It was average. I mean, the only proven commodity you have on that team is Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
Matt LaFleur has done nothing.
Yeah, but at some point you're going to need a new quarterback, so when's the right time to get that guy? I guess that's the question that you have to ask yourself if you're the general manager from an organizational standpoint. When do we start the clock on Aaron Rodgers and start looking toward our future and who's going to be under center for the next decade plus? I mean, there is no good time. It was going to happen eventually while Aaron Rodgers was on his contract. There's no doubt about that. So whether it was this offseason or the following offseason, you know, they were probably going to be in the market for a quarterback. And when you look at Jordan Love's talent and recognize that the kid probably needs a couple of years to sit and be groomed, I guess they just felt like this was the perfect time to make that decision.
Yeah, but I'm not necessarily even talking just about the pick. I mean, we can go back and forth about if you like the pick or not and if Jordan Love's going to turn into, I mean, to listen to their GM wax poetic that he's the gunslinger. You know, if, you know, Brett Favre and his gunslinging and Aaron Rodgers and his ability to throw on different platforms and with a touch of Pat Mahomes. I mean, come on, relax. I mean, that's you just created the greatest quarterback of all time.
That's a good pick if that's the case.
No, but it's the entirety of the draft, man. I mean, it's okay. These are the wide receivers that we liked. And then, you know, by the time it got to us, well, you just actively went up and gave up a fourth round pick for a quarterback that's not going to help you. And you're going to try to explain to your franchise quarterback that you didn't want to trade up to get a wide or take any wide receivers.
And then you reach for a running back in the second round. Yeah, I agree. I think that not taking a receiver, they didn't take a receiver. The closest they came was taking a tight end, not taking a receiver and having Alan Lazard as a guy that you're relying on to produce.
Yeah, but Dave, not even that though. Forget the skill positions, right? You take a running back and then Gutekunst, who, I mean, I'm telling you right now, they start losing games. They take a step back. That name is not going to be pronounced properly. I can promise you that. There'll be a nasty ending to that name. Now all of a sudden you want to run the football. Okay, if you want to run the football, you're not fully taking advantage of having one of the best quarterbacks in the National Football League. But more importantly, you run the football when you have a really good defense, right? Well, your defense isn't really good. You got gashed.
Yeah.
And you didn't help your defense.
Run off the field in the NFC Championship game. Can't wait for Allen Houston to join the show. You think it's fair to say, Rick, the biggest shot? I guess probably not the biggest shot in Knicks history, but one of the biggest shots in Knicks history. If I asked you, like, the biggest shots, that's got to be right up there, right? The shot against
Yeah, that's got to be right up there. Has to be. Has to be. 100%.
That was a huge, huge shot.
Yeah, by the way, too, Dave, I mean, the more you say it when we start breaking down The Last Dance and how I keep fighting it, it doesn't have an emotional effect on me.
It's awful.
I can't hide it anymore. Did you see what, I mean, did you watch SportsCenter?
No.
And that they did the top 10 most disrespectful dunks?
Yes.
Was it the Pippen on Ewing's got to be up there, right?
I don't know. I saw the one that was number one. What was that, the Scottie Pippen one?
Oh, yeah.
The one on Ewing, right?
Yeah, the one on Ewing. But I don't know how the one with Sean Kemp was not more disrespectful, where he dunks on the guy and then he points at him afterward.
Well, Pippen was yelling at Ewing when he dunked on him. He was yelling at him.
Yeah, he walked right over him. And then, I mean, Jordan was on the list dunking on Ewing, too, on the top 10.
Right. Great. See, I don't understand how you could watch that and just feel great about it. Let's bring him in. Allen Houston with us here on 98.7 ESPN. Allen, we have so many directions we want to go in with you, and we appreciate a couple minutes here on a Friday.
How you guys doing, man? You staying safe out there?
We're safe and hanging in there best we can. Let's start with, I mean, because this is big for everybody. Everyone is enjoying it and having, like, memories back during the day. Are you enjoying? Well, first of all, you're watching, and if you are you enjoying The Last Dance up to this point?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it because, you know, it's fun for me watching it with my son. And you know, when you have a younger generation that didn't get a chance to see Michael, see what he meant to the game, you know, the way he influenced Kobe and now how Kobe influenced LeBron. And you got to see kind of – and then Michael was influenced by Dr. J. And so you just get to see the evolution of what made him who he was and playing for Dean Smith and being coached and – You know, that's what I appreciate is the historical context and how this generation is getting to see what created, you know, what the soil was, what fertilized Michael.
Allen, when you watch this documentary, I mean, you bring up Kobe in the comparison. Do you find yourself sometimes watching Michael play and how eerily similar how Kobe played was, like some of the mannerisms and everything else are?
Yeah, I mean, but even years ago, watching Kobe, that you saw that when he was playing. But again, I think you can break down Michael and see how explosive he was. You can, to me, you really look, you can see a little bit of the differences, but it is you definitely can see the things that are similar that Kobe emulated, the footwork. But I think when I'm looking at Michael, even back in high school, college, his early years. Just how explosive, you know, he was. And I think that most people saw how athletic he was, but the other thing is how fundamentally sound, you know, he was. And I think Kenny Smith mentioned that in one of his shows. Is that's what I really, what sticks out to me.
Allen, a huge part of the conversation in sports this week came from episode 4 of the Last Dance docuseries when Michael Jordan goes back in time and talks about the 91 playoff series, the Eastern Conference Finals against the Pistons when they finally broke through, and how he still felt the way about Isaiah Thomas and the Pistons not shaking their hands after that series was over. What did you make of that move by Isaiah and the Pistons?
Well, I heard so much of that. See, first of all, Isaiah was my mentor in Detroit, right? You know, when I first was a Piston, Lindsey Hunter and I came in, and Joe Dumars. So I learned up under those. So I was there and understood the mentality, you know, what they went through. And so I think Isaiah honestly feels and believes that at that time, you know, that he was just, they were keeping the persona of the bad boys. I think that's what he believes. I definitely think there's a respect to the game, though. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you saw John Sally didn't do it. And Michael said in the film, like, you know, we lost 7 games. We didn't do it. I just think that was, they had built so much of that persona. That's what they did at that time.
Allen Houston joining us here, 98.7 ESPN. So they won 3, then they had the 2-year sabbatical and they came back and won 3 again with Dennis Rodman. Do you look at either of the first or second incarnations of the Bulls and think that's the better version of those two teams?
That's a good question. I think it's every year is different. You go through different challenges. You know, I don't know which I would say what's the best version. You know, when you're older, you know, you're more mature. You can see when they came back. It's probably more impressive, you know, that he came back and took that time off and they were all able to do it again. That's impressive to me. I don't know which is the better version. That's probably more impressive to me because you're older and things, it's grueling, the mental grind. And so to do that again and come back afterwards is impressive to me.
All right, Alan, let's stop beating around the bush. I think what every Knicks fan wants to know, and this has nothing to do with the current roster or anything else, just more of, you know, the narrative surrounding the New York Knicks. How do we change it? Like, how do we get, you know, players that are willing to sign on and be a part of this team and help to restore, you know, the New York Knicks brand a little bit?
Yeah, it's something that I get every day. You know, I was very fortunate to come at a time where the foundation had been laid, right? You know, Patrick and Oak and John and Herb Williams, they set that foundation. And I think the thing that you got to know in this game, that one or two people can change the game. And I think that what you want to do is you want to develop your younger players. And I think that's really, you set that culture, you set that foundation, you put everything into making them as the best they can be. And I think that's where you have to start. And, you know, free agency is, you know, it's different now. So you have to really build a foundation, and that's really what I was very fortunate to walk into.
Alan, I want to ask you about the NBA G League. Sharif Abdur-Rahim, he's been developing the program now with the G League and trying to create a pipeline for high school athletes that don't want to go to college. And you're starting to see some high-profile kids, Jalen Green, Isaiah Todd, and most recently Dacian Nix, decide that they're going to forego the opportunity to go to college and enter into the G League. I want to ask you your thoughts on that. And had you been offered that opportunity, would you have made that decision coming out of high school?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think under today's culture, I think it's what most young players now are thinking about. The thing, when you're 13, now every young person has a brand, and they're trying to figure that out. And so, yes, I do think that this is the G League is about development, right? The reason that the NBA wants to have a league is because you don't have to go to college now. So now it's going to be one of those things where, how do we develop our young talent? How do we develop, have a development mentality? How do we prepare them not only to play in the league physically for that grind, but how do we prepare? Are they going to be prepared for the mental and the emotional and even the spiritual side of playing this game and maximizing it? So if you can have a player that can do that under your watch, give them the best resources, and then now you can kind of offer them that financial, support and do that. Now that's what I think most players are going to be a lot of players are going to be looking at.
Alan Houston with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So if that happens, and Chris just mentioned the three guys that have decided to go to the G League over college basketball, do you worry at all for the future of college basketball if the best and brightest decides to go right to the G League and forego college at all?
I don't know if I worry about it, because you're still going to have so many, you know, good basketball players are going to be playing in college. You know, you might have a few of those. I don't worry about college basketball because it's such a dynamic, you know, it's such a lifestyle. It's part of what we do. My thing is, how are these young people going to be best equipped for life? At the end of the day, that's really what it comes, you know, that comes down to. And so now, if you can take that approach and start to, you know, understand your value at a younger age and be able to manage that, then that's a good thing. But I don't worry about college basketball, because I think there's a lot of young, talented athletes that are still going to have an opportunity to compete.
Alan Houston joins us in the show. Alan, I played hockey. Chris played football. Dave plays with himself. But, I mean, just try to bring in the mindset of an NBA player now trying to, you know, if this thing does come back, you know, how hard would it be to get back to where you need to be to compete for a championship at this point?
It's tough because this is something that I don't think any of the athletes have ever been. I mean, how long has it been? They've never experienced not picking up a ball, playing, competing, going somewhere, and having that opportunity for this long amount of time. So it's going to be a new shift for everyone. And so it does take weeks. I mean, it takes weeks to really get your body back, to get your timing, get your rhythm. When people come back from injury, even if they've taken time off and they've had the ball in their hand, there's a rhythm that gets affected. So I think, you know, Adam, I think everyone's going to take the necessary approach to make sure health is insured first, and then you take it from there.
Alan, in discussing the path forward, some of the things that have come up about resuming play and hopefully getting to a situation where you're able to crown a champ, I know the NBA has talked about not wanting to jeopardize what happens in the 2020-2021 season. So what ultimately ends up being the priority? Is it actually resuming the current season, or is it making sure that you're able to keep intact next season?
I mean, I haven't been in these conversations, but if you, my perspective is you want to make sure that everything's insured for what you do know, and that is the beginning of the next season, right? I think it just gives everyone a deadline, a chance to prepare properly. There's going to be so many things that we don't even know how they're going to work this summer, let alone, you know, when October comes, right? So I think the priority, I think, the highest priority would probably be to make sure you can ensure that the beginning of next season is on time.
Alan Houston with us here, 98.7 ESPN. You know, it's funny, John Starks was with us in studio not so long ago, and I asked him, how often when you walk down the street do people come up to you and say, the dunk over Jordan, the dunk? He said, every single day. So let me ask you a similar question to that. I mean, we talked about before you joined us about the shot you made against Miami. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was a Sunday afternoon. Hit the rim a couple times, bounced in. How often when you're allowed to walk the street, when you go back to and used to be allowed to walk the streets, how often did that get mentioned to you, that shot against Miami?
I think when people recognize me, that's what they say. it's funny walking the street, then people are like, wait a minute, it paused, but I do get reminded that, you know, when I interact with Knicks fans and just people in general who were around, I get it. I get that almost every day.
All right, Alan, last one for me. What's your preference? I don't know if you've been asked this. I'm sure you have at some point. I know we're sitting here kind of going back in time, watching The Last Dance and everything else. What is your preference? I mean, having a chance to be, you know, as involved as you are now with where the game's at. Did you prefer the style back then, or do you prefer what we're seeing now in the NBA?
Oh, man. You know, this is a whole nother show, man. You know, I think that people talk and they say, Alan, you would have loved to play in today's game. But I don't think you can really say, because the game was different. The three-point line was not as prevalent. You know, I see a lot of the shots that players are taking now. And, you know, would I have been able to take those shots now and make them? Maybe. You know, I would have maybe shot more threes and it would have been different. But part of our game was to utilize the mid-range and the two-point game more. And that was a big part of, you know, I heard Kobe, Michael, Vince Carter, Tracy McGrady, all the two guards during our era, that was a big part of the game. So now that's not as much a part of the game. So that would have been a much different. It would have been different. You know, I don't know. I just like how we played. I really do. It was tough. You know, going through it was in practices were tough. I mean, it was a different style. This would have been. Would it have been more fun to play in this? Maybe. So I don't have a preference either way. I think if you have good fundamentals, and you can shoot the basketball, I think in any era, you know, you can be effective.
Now, I did a little digging before you joined us here today. Is this correct? You have seven children?
Yeah. So I have seven. My wife and I have been, you know, together 24 years. I have a junior in NYU, a freshman at Brown, and you know, we it's This is a new. It's a new day. Same place, but a new day every day in the South.
What is quarantining like in your home? I have two, and I'm overwhelmed by the end of the day. Rick has two, and it's a lot. You have seven children. What is it like?
Yeah, it's honestly a ball because the one thing that we know, we never get this time again. And I was talking to my father-in-law last night about it. He's like, you know, you're going to make some impressions on them that'll last forever during this time. And so I try to, you know, we try to keep it in the biggest perspective, you know, just stay prayed up every day, you know, and try to enjoy it and maximize it and think about, you know, not what we're going through now, but think about what it's going to be like when we get out of it. But it does get claustrophobic. Everybody has their needs to have their space, but we're enjoying it.
Well, we're glad. We're glad you could join us for a couple minutes. So enjoy your family. Hold them close, certainly. And, it's true. You'll never get this time again. I'm sure your kids that are in college are desperate to get out of the house, but you'll never get this time again.
but they know that they're covered.
Well, it's good to hear. And it's good to hear that you guys are safe and sound. We appreciate a couple minutes. And, you know, hopefully when we get out of this thing, we'll have you on again and really break down the Knicks and all the NBA stuff. So good stuff, Alan. We appreciate it.
That was good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks,
absolutely. Nope. Yep. That, of course, is Alan Houston there joining us on 98.7 ESPN. Today on ESPN Daily, Alex Smith suffered one of the most gruesome injuries in NFL history. Nearly cost him his leg, nearly cost him his life in 2018. Smith reflects on his ordeal, and ESPN's Stefania Bell details the amazing medical effort to treat him. That's ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. And Stefania's going to join us in about 10 minutes here on 98.7. I can't imagine. Do you see how many surgeries he had, Rick?
Yeah, I think it's, 17 surgeries on his leg?
17 surgeries.
Yeah, it's crazy.
For the one injury.
Yeah, well, I mean, Chris, you saw Chris's wrist. I mean, once you start getting an infection inside the bone in the surgery, yeah, I mean, that's touch and go at that point.
And they're saying he had a flesh-eating bacteria in his leg. That's a gruesome injury to start with, but when you have the complication of the infection and then getting sepsis, it was a whole lot going on in Alex Smith's life that I don't think anybody had a clue about. Like, we knew it was going to be, you know, a long road to recovery for that type of injury that he had, but I don't think anybody had any idea, you know, what he was going through at that time.
Yeah, so that's tonight. It's an hour, 7:30 to 8:30. It's E60, and Stefania Bell, she was with him for a year and went to, you know, the hospital and doctors and all sorts of stuff. So she'll join us at about 12:15. Did you see the story? This is unbelievable to me. David Falk said that Michael Jordan was offered $100 million to make either a 2-hour appearance or something involved with the company for 2 hours and turned it down.
I didn't see that. Did he explain why he turned it down?
He just said Michael is very selective in the things that he decides to do it and not do.
Yeah, I mean, there would have to be a really good reason to turn down $100 million for
$100 million.
Dave, he doesn't look at $100 million the way that we do.
Yeah, but when was that? Was that recently? That couldn't have been recently.
I don't think it was that long ago.
I mean, who's got enough money to offer someone $100 million for 2 hours?
Now you're asking the right question, Rico.
Dude, what kind of company is this, right?
Did you see the other story? I was going to bring this up a while back, but we ran out of time and I forgot about it.
Here's what it says. $100 million appearance fee to show up in an event. Why? Simply because he just didn't feel like showing up. He didn't want to do it.
Yeah, when you have as much money as Michael Jordan does, I mean, why would you do something that you don't want to do? At that point, is the money really that significant? He's got enough money to get anything. He's got enough money to get anything that he wants, Dave.
Here's how it goes down, Rick. So it was 3 years ago. Falk says for $100 million, all he had to do was, other than giving his name and likeness, make one 2-hour appearance to announce the deal, turned it down, didn't want to do it.
To announce what deal, though? I mean, it would depend on what the deal is. Like, maybe he didn't feel comfortable with the company or whatever it was?
I guess.
You can't, if it's just because you don't want to give up 2 hours, I don't care how much money you have, that's unacceptable. 2 hours for $100 million? Come on.
$100 million.
It's crazy. Would you care to guess? You probably saw this story, maybe you forgot. When Michael Jordan left the NBA to play baseball, would you care to guess which Major League Baseball GM offered him a spot on the major league roster?
So it's got to be a team obviously looking for attention.
Doesn't have to be team. It could just think GM.
GM looking for attention, though, right?
Oh, yeah, for attention. I mean, maybe he has done this recently. Tried this recently.
With Tebow?
Oh, yeah. Sandy Alderson.
Really?
Yeah. Offered him a spot right on the Major League roster. Didn't have to go play in the minors. But because Reinsdorf owned the White Sox and Jordan wanted to actually feel like he earned it, he said no.
Well, that would have been a farce. I mean, Michael Jordan in the majors would have been awful.
Yeah, but people would have showed up, though, Dave.
Of course they would have.
People would have been there.
it almost feels like that's anti-Sandy Alderson, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, knowing the man based on, yeah, I'm with you on that one, Dave.
But he brought Tebow into the Mets organization. He didn't say, like, you're going to be our starting left fielder every day.
Yeah, but Tim Tebow's not Michael Jordan.
I know.
I mean, Tim Tebow didn't just come off three straight NBA championships. The biggest, I mean, at that point, was Michael Jordan the biggest celebrity in the world at that point?
In the world.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think Michael Jordan ranks now as biggest celebrity in the world?
Well, after the release of this documentary that everyone's watching?
He's still got to be up there, Dave. His sneakers alone made $130 million last year.
I mean, he's been retired for, what, 20 years?
And
yes. So think about that. You think that there's any athlete, you think Pat Mahomes... So say he plays another 10 years. So say 30 years from now, you think that Pat Mahomes is going to be at that level of celebrity?
No. No.
I don't see that.
Michael Jordan pioneered. I mean, he took the NBA and made it a global entity. I mean, how many Tiger Woods is there going to be?
I can't foresee another.
Okay. So, I mean, there's something to be said about the first one to do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think LeBron could. I don't know that he'll be at that level, but I think LeBron's going to be a big deal 20 years after he retires.
Yeah, I think LeBron will be a big deal, but he won't be as big as Jordan.
No.
And I think that's the point. Like Rick said, when you're the first one through the door in terms of being able to brand yourself as an athlete and then globalize your game the way that he has, I mean, I don't see another athlete being able to do that. Like, I mean, Tom Brady for football, Tiger Woods for golf. I mean, like, it's going to be that much harder to do it. I don't think that you're going to have any athletes in those respective sports come along and eclipse what those guys have done.
Yeah, you could be right. Let's quickly go to a call or two, and then we'll bring in Stefania Bell, who's going to join us. Let's go to Jack in Hackensack. Jack, you're next up on 98.7.
Good morning, guys. I'm in a lot better frame of mind than the last time I spoke with you. But first off, let me thank you guys for what you do. All us hospital workers need a little break, and we can turn you guys on and get the break that we need. Secondly, with good news from the hospital, we have our admissions are way, way down. Our discharges are way, way up. We're still not out of the woods, but we're doing great. Let me get to the Jets a little bit. I've been a season ticket holder since 1977, consecutive. And I love when you had Joe Douglas on. He knows what he's doing. Sounds like he wants to keep Adams. And I think the draft picks were great so far. So, again, thank you guys for everything you're doing for us.
Oh, well, thank you for everything you're doing for us. I mean, really, we're just sitting here talking sports, which is not so different than what we do on a day-in, day-out basis, but it's people like you that are making the huge difference. James in the Bronx. James, you're next up on 98.7.
First time, long time. What's going on, fellas?
What's up, James?
Not much. I have a question for all of you, but Chris Kenny, I want your expertise on this one.
What you got?
What do you think? I'm from the Bronx, too, brother, so good to speak to you.
BX, stand up.
Yeah, you already. I just want to say, what do you think about the Dallas Cowboys just getting done with Dak Prescott and bringing in Cam Newton?
I don't think that's going to happen. Dak Prescott is your future. Cam Newton is just a bridge to that future. I don't know why you would get rid of a guy that you can have a decade of good quarterback play from for a guy that you're only going to have for two or three seasons.
But because he wants a lot of money, $30 million above $30 million, that's going to take a lot from.
That's the going rate for quarterbacks, man. They just paid Wentz and Goff $34 million a year. Those are two quarterbacks that were a part of his draft class. I mean, that's Jerry Jones and Stephen Jones are just going to have to come to grips that that's what Dak Prescott is going to cost. And while they're right in the middle of that Super Bowl window, I don't know why you would interrupt what you've been building toward by changing your quarterback.
Very valid. Very valid. Thanks, man. I appreciate you guys.
My
All
man.
Right. Thank you, James. We appreciate it. All right. Let's turn our attention to the documentary that debuts tonight, 7:30 on ESPN. And that, of course, is the Alex Smith story on E60. And a good friend of mine, Stefania Bell, heavily involved in putting this this hour-long feature together. We welcome her in. Of course, she's from the award-winning fantasy focus podcast, Stefania Bell. How you doing, Stefania?
I'm good, Dave. I miss you.
I miss you as well. We had some fun times doing fantasy football on Sunday mornings. All right, let's get right to it. First of all, how did this come about, this story with you getting involved in the Alex Smith injury and kind of detailing it for a year? And like, what's the genesis of how this whole thing started for you?
It started with a phone call from Dr. Robin West, the team physician for Washington, who obviously through the course of all this has become very close with Alex and his wife, Elizabeth. And it was January, and he had been through the most harrowing part of this experience, his early stay in the hospital, and recognized that he still faced a very long road to recovery, and had asked her who he could look to as an example, who's been through this type of thing before, who should I reach out to? And she had to tell him, there really isn't anyone who's had an injury quite like yours. And I think those conversations led to the idea that maybe it would be a good thing to document the past, because who knows who it might impact, or somebody going through something similar that it might help. And so that was the origin. Dr. West and I have known each other professionally for a number of years because of my background in sports medicine. And she told Alex and his wife she thought I would be a good fit for the story. And so we had a phone call, all of us, and agreed to do it. And I brought it to ESPN, and the rest is history.
Stefania, I know you kind of mentioned it in, you know, reading some of the stuff, watching some of the stuff previous with Alex Smith and the injury and everything else. In your career, had you ever seen, I mean, all in total with the, you know, the bacteria and everything else, had you ever seen anything as bad as what Alex Smith was dealing with?
No, not in my personal experience. I mean, certainly I've heard about these type of injuries, and you know, we talk in the piece, and we talked about them going down to San Antonio to the military medical center because his injury was much more resembled a war injury as opposed to a sports injury. So, you know, yes, those types of injuries exist, but they typically come from the battlefield, not from the football field.
Stefania, you talked about everything, you know, the thought process in terms of why you guys wanted to document it. But in looking at this situation from a mental health standpoint, was this documentation of this process, was that in any way therapeutic for Alex?
That's a really interesting question, and you'd have to ask him. You know, that's a great question. No one's asked me that, and I don't know. You know, we made a commitment to be as authentic as possible. Alex wanted it to be very real. He wanted it to be represent the good days and the bad days. In other words, we were given this access that was complete. And there was never a time when he said, you know, I'm not having the greatest day, let's not do this. Or I don't want you in for this doctor's appointment. You know, I don't know what the news is going to be. He was, once he committed, he was all in and he wanted us there. And I think that it was empowering to him and his wife to be able to deliver this story in total, as opposed to the rumors and speculation, which, of course, there was a lot of that in the early phase. And that's sort of why they went quiet. You know, it was just there was too much, and it was a complicated injury, and they just didn't really want to talk about it until they could tell the complete story. So I think there was a sense of controlling that narrative, and not that they controlled the content, we did, but they had us there for all of it so that we could really see all the ins and outs and the nuances. And I think they trusted that this would be the more complete, as I said, authentic story for them. And so I do think that that had to provide some sort of positive, you know, positivity for Alex. But again, you'd have to ask him, and I think it's a really great question.
Stefania Bell with us here on 98.7 ESPN. So for those that don't know, I mean, he suffered this gruesome injury back in 2018. I think it was against the Texans. But how bad was, like, there was a real chance that he was gonna die, right? And then on top of that, then once they knew that he was gonna live, there was a realer chance that he could potentially lose his leg at some point. I mean, tell people how bad, how severe this really was.
You're exactly right. There was a chance that he could lose his life. Essentially, what happened when he had the injury, he had this complex fracture and a spiral fracture of his tibia shin bone that went from his ankle up to his knee. And most people think of a fracture like a clean break across the bone, right? The line that you see on an x-ray. Well, his was as if it was a corkscrew up the leg. And so that left a lot of sharp edges and pieces. And one of those poked through the skin. And the minute you have an open wound that's created by a fracture, you have the opportunity to introduce all sorts of bacteria. And that's why it becomes an emergency situation. You get to the hospital, they take you to surgery, they wash out the wound, they flood you with antibiotics, and they repair the fracture. And all those things were done. But bacteria are microscopic, and sometimes they're pretty resilient. And it just takes a couple of them to hunker down, and then they can surface later and become a problem. And that's essentially what happened. And within a few days of him having the injury on the field, the infection had taken over, and that's what threatened his life. And so that touch-and-go phase, I would say, was there for about a week. And there was a point where there was a question of whether they might have to sacrifice his leg to save his life, but they wanted to preserve it if they could. And ultimately, as we all know, he still has his leg. But even when he got out from that, the damage had been done to his leg from the tissue damage that the infection had caused. And so there was still a period of time where Alex was uncertain whether he would ultimately be able to keep his leg. And I think that struggle is quite remarkable. And I think you'll get a sense of that when you watch the piece.
Stefania, what role did Alex's kids play in, you know, him wanting to document this and how hard he fought to try to get back to where he is now?
I think that was definitely a big part of it was, this is a family story too. And I think that will resonate with a lot of people. Alex's number one goal when he was out of the hospital was to get back to being a dad and a husband like he used to be. You know, he wanted to be able to run around with his kids, and his kids are young. They're active as all young kids are and sports kids. And he just wanted to be able to play with them and do things with them again. That was his number one motivator. But I think, because they were shielded from the worst of it, as you would expect. Elizabeth, his wife, did a remarkable job of sort of holding down the fort at home and being there for her husband. And, I think them being able to have this story as a family and at some point to be able to say, these are all the things that we went through and look, we're thriving. It's a pretty strong testament to the integrity of the family.
Stefania, I know Alex's health and general well-being should be the focal point of everything that's going on around this documentary, but is there any thought about Alex returning to football in any capacity?
Well, Alex has said himself that remains a very real goal. And I will tell you one thing I learned about this guy. He is uber competitive, driven, focused, like laser focused, and he proceeded to demonstrate over and over again that he could exceed expectations. All these goals in physical therapy that were laid out for him and goals that he made for himself, he just kept outperforming. And I think as that happened along the way, it became apparent to him that, hey, football might be a real possibility. And he loves the challenge. And now he's got this challenge of potentially being able to do something no one's ever done before. And I think that challenge appeals to him and motivates him. So whether it happens or not, who's to say? It's hard even in the context of what's going on with the COVID-19 pandemic to appreciate what a normal football schedule will look like. We don't even know. So timelines are potentially skewed. We don't know at this point. And that also could impact what happens. But right now, he's doing all the other things his teammates are doing, virtual workouts. studying the playbook, preparing for an NFL season. So I've said this once, and I'll say it 100 times. I will not be the one who say that Alex can't come back. He's certainly impressed me along this journey, and I am a believer at this point, and given the recovery he's made to date, that if this is something he wants to do, wouldn't surprise me at all if he does it.
Last one for me, Stefania. And Stefania Bell here with us here on 98.7 ESPN. I know if this was me, if I had an injury like that and had 17 surgeries and almost lost my life and the leg was almost amputated, that my wife would say, it's not going to happen. You had a terrific career. You're not going back and playing this again. I mean, what does his wife say when he says, I'd like to give this another shot of going back to the NFL?
Well, Dave, you've given me a great chance to plug my piece that's on ESPN.com today that's written through the eyes of his wife, Elizabeth.
You think this is an accident? This is no accident, Stefania. I've known you for a long time. I know the questions to ask.
You're kind of good at this hosting gig. They should keep you. So I don't totally want to give it away because I really, really want you to go and read and see what she says. But I will tell you that, you know, as you would expect, is a complicated answer. She was the only one who was coherent through all of the time that he was in the hospital. You know, Alex was on a substantial amount of pain medication and wasn't really present for the worst part of it. So as awful as it was for him to nearly lose his life, he honestly didn't realize that was happening around him. And so, as you say, for her going through all of that, you can imagine that the prospect of doing anything that would potentially put him at jeopardy again is daunting. But as I said, it's a complicated answer, and she addresses it. So go take a look at the piece.
Yeah, that would be difficult. That would be difficult. I mean, just worrying about if, you know, you made that decision and told him no, if he would resent you later not being. Stefania, I want to ask you one. Just this is not related to Alex Smith, but I figured I'd ask you because we keep talking about it every single day because he's still not signed. How concerned are teams with Cam Newton's health? Is there real concern? Is that the reason why he's not signed yet?
You know, I don't think level of concern is reflected in that. I just think it's literally they can't do physicals. Nobody can see him. And until they're at a point where travel is permitted, and I think that you're going to see some of that, you know, who knows, as things change in different states, I think there's going to be some ability for some players to get physicals done. And maybe for others, it will be more of a challenge. I mean, when travel's involved, it starts to get more difficult. But in cities, if a player's located in the same city as the team physician and they want to bring them in for a physical, you know, some of these facilities were just closed or team physicians were being shuffled to different roles or just not allowed to do elective patient visits, et cetera. So, is it really a function of what's happening regionally and locally? But you might see that some players will be able to get a physical done, and then others, you know, if they were going to be somebody who's potentially moving across the country, for example, that might present more of a challenge. But I think in the case of Cam, if teams can't see him and bring him in and decide for themselves, he's going to remain in limbo. And that doesn't surprise me. I mean, he's coming off not only the foot surgery recently, but he never really resumed much playing after having his shoulder scoped again. So teams are going to want to take a closer look.
Stefania, generally speaking, how real is the concern around the injury rate going up as athletes look to return to sports?
I think it's all about the ramp-up time. I've spoken with a couple of head athletic trainers and team physicians about that exact topic, and one of my friends said to me, you know, give me 6 to 8 weeks with the guys, and I'll feel pretty good. That's about the amount of time I'd like to see them have to, you know, if they come in shape and we get, you know, this about 6 weeks with them, I would feel pretty good. But if it's, nobody wants to see a short ramp-up time because we always know that injuries tend to spike during training camp and again in the preseason early on, especially soft tissue injuries. And that comes from lack of conditioning. And even if guys have good intentions, people have different setups. I mean, some people really just can't train the way they normally would. So I think it's hard to expect them to come in and be just football ready, and we'll do a shortened version of training camp. So I think the collective intelligence would say we can't make this a super short ramp-up time, or we're going to run into trouble with injury.
All right, Stefania, we appreciate a couple minutes. I know it's going to be great tonight on ESPN 730, the Alex Smith E60, and how heavily involved you are and from the beginning of this whole thing. So thanks so much. Continued success to you, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me. I hope you guys enjoy the program.
All right, thanks. That, of course, is Stefania Bell. I got to tell you, I'm really, and I don't know if it's like a morbid thing. I don't think it is. I'm really looking forward to watching this tonight at 1 hour, E60, 730.
Yeah, when you see what he's going to go through during the course of this documentary.
You saw the photo that I tweeted out the other day, right?
Yeah, I saw the photo. When I keep watching, I mean, some of the clips that they show teasing leading into tonight. And, I mean, when you talk about the amount of damage that this bacteria did to his leg and how much work it took to try to get his leg back to where, I mean, he could actually maybe someday be able to use it. Like, there was no guarantee that even if they, you know, did whatever they could to try to save the leg, that he'd have use of it. No. He'd be able to move his, like, lift his foot. And to think that he's now actually doing virtual, I mean, he's doing the virtual off-season program, expecting that maybe he could play football again, is you're going to be, you won't believe it. It won't make any sense to you.
Is he still part of a team?
Yeah,
he's Washington.
He's still on Washington.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, man, and you guys can certainly speak to this more than I ever could. Rick, I mean, if you had an injury like this, wouldn't your wife just say, like, it's not worth it, you got to shut it down?
No.
No, she would want you to wanted to?
No, because it's, I mean, when you have, and her wife, I mean, his wife went through the worst of it. I mean, when it's a legitimate partnership and it's, I mean, you got kids and your wife's doing, you know, all the extra stuff to make sure that you can do exactly what you need to do, and you're put in a situation where, you know, he battles back from this and now gives himself the opportunity. She doesn't want him to, but she doesn't want to be the one to tell him he can't, because now all of a sudden what happens? You know what
right.
I mean?
Like, you know, for the rest of his... get it, because now you're going to have issues forever because she wouldn't let you come back.
Yeah, like now you resent her for that.
But I don't even think it's a thought in the athlete's mind. I mean, I didn't have any injury anywhere near as serious as what Alex had to deal with, but I told you guys about the injury I had in college where my kneecap and my foot were facing opposite directions. I mean, that was a situation where I tore three ligaments and they were worried about damage to the artery and the nerve in that area. And you were talking about whether or not it was a situation they needed to amputate. But I mean, in my mind, I never once thought that if I keep my leg, I never once thought about not playing football. Not once.
It's amazing.
So I don't even know if that's a part of your mentality when you're going through something. Now, I will say this, Alex, you know, he had to have a hell of an optimistic outlook, because, I mean, your mind goes into some dark places, but according to Stefania, she didn't see any of that. So I think that's a testament to the man and the mental fortitude that he has, like, because that's about as bad as it can get as far as injuries go in the NFL, Dave. I mean, that's awful. I mean, and the fact that he was able to see his way through to the other side of this thing, even to be in position to consider coming back to football, I mean, that just shows you the character of the person you're dealing with.
It sure does.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.